I asked for the Albert Hall, and look what I got. Never mind. Well, I've been, you know, I've been doing this. It's amazing. I've been 51 years. I've been pulling funny faces and doing funny walks. And of course, as this is steam radio, funny voices as well, you see. And I haven't been found out yet. But of course, in that time, it's extraordinary. One collects so many yarns, so many tales, and I suppose you could say I'm in my anecdotage, really. But one of the things you have to be very careful of at my age and in the biz is I've got a picture of two young actors in a rehearsal room, and they say, look out, here he comes, he'll bore the arse off you, really, to tell you how he did a film with this one and how he did this wonderfully successful. So I try not to anecdote too much. I do it at home, and my children are very honest. They say, we've heard it, Dad, three times. And some of my best friends, too, also tell me, but I don't recognise anybody here, so you've not heard any of these anecdotes before, I'm happy to say. I'd like to talk about my triumphs and the various amazing, wonderful parts I've played, but unfortunately, the public have a taste for disaster. One of my worst, undoubtedly, because it's every actor's terror. Well, I suppose every actor's nightmare is to be on stage, naked, and you don't know what the play is. But this was worse in a way, because it was the first time I did Death of a Salesman, and I suppose I'm connected with that play. I've done it four times. It is, in the director's opinion, Michael Rudman, the second greatest play in the English language after Hamlet, and I have to agree with that. I think it's a wonderful play. And I've played Willie four times now. The first time I did it was a very modest production in Perth in Western Australia for the West Australian National Theatre, which is really just a semi-amateur company it was in those days. We had 2 weeks to rehearse this magnificent play. And I was petrified on opening night, and I came up the stairs into our bedroom, my wife and Linda, and I came in, I said, Linda, I couldn't make it, Linda. I came back, I was driving along, and total blank. I had no idea what came next. And then I said, suddenly I couldn't drive anymore. The car was going off the road and it went again. And I said, I remembered one other. Did Biff say anything after I left this morning? I'll go and get some cheese and crackers. And I walked out the door and I stood outside the bedroom door and I thought, I've left out half the play. The whole plot is in that first scene. So I went back in and I said, Linda, it's really beautiful up there. I was driving along and, you know, it was really beautiful. You mean on the road every day of my life. The car was... I'll go and get some cheese and crackers. And I walked out the door again. And I stood outside the bedroom door and I thought, I've got to put the points of the plot across. And I went back in. I did it four times, dithering and by then, my tongue was stuck to the roof. Have you ever had that? When you try and smile and, you know, your lips are stuck on the teeth and I clanged and I was just shattered. And I went down the stairs and I slumped over the kitchen table and the scene with the two sons in the bedroom starts. And I lay there and I thought, well, you've lost the first sex, six love, now come on, get on with it. And the play is so great that the play took over and somehow or other we got through the evening and the director came round and said, wow, that was some dry. And I said, yeah, I'm sorry, but it just went. He said, but don't worry about it. He said, a woman came up to me and said, look, when Mr. Mitchell stood outside that bedroom door dithering, I knew exactly who the character was. That was the most brilliant piece of acting I've ever seen of a man who couldn't make up his mind, and that's why he was in the state he was in. And I've never been able to act as well as that ever since. What was I doing in Australia, I hear you ask? Good question. I tell you, I used to get phone calls when Till Death Us Do Part, Alf, first came on the screen. I used to get phone calls from a man called Ernest Stewart Bucket, who was the welfare officer of Maidstone Jail, and used to write these most preposterous letters like, dear Mr. Mitchell, if you'll come and entertain my prisoners on Sunday night, Prince Philip has agreed to come as well. And I thought, anyone who can tell lies like that on behalf of a bunch of convicts really deserves very serious attention. So I rang up Johnny Spate, the late Johnny Spate, the wonderful writer of ALF, and I said, do you think, I had this idea, I thought, do you think I could do a bit of stand-up bit as ALF? And he said, yeah, all right, sonny. And at the time, the breathalyzer test had just started, and he wrote this outrageous bit. I said, Johnny, I can't do that. These are convicts, these are men who... He said, no, they'll love it. So I went down to Maidstone Jail and I did this bit, which Johnny had written, all about, you know, Barbara Castle, that Labour MP cow, she started this, all because she couldn't afford a motor car herself and she didn't want no one else to have one. Politics of envy. She's ruined the car trade. I mean, no one's going to buy a car and walk out the pub, are they? And it went on about, you know, the breathalyzer and how it was, people drive better drunk than sober. I mean, never mind that, breathalyze your House of Commons, breathalyze your House of Lords. They go down there, they make their laws, half of them are pissed out their heads, aren't they? And it went on, and it finished with him saying, it's not fair. You lot in here are the proper professional criminal classes, ain't you? And you are being asked to vacate your cells to make room for a bunch of drunken drivers. It's not fair. Some of you have been in them cells for years. They should have some consideration. And I was petrified. I'd never done stand-up. But it was going, as you can imagine, Johnny was right. They loved it, although I thought it was heartless. But I didn't know how long... I knew they had to be back in their cells by 9:30. I turned to the wings and I said to Ernest Stewart Bucket, how long have I got, Ernest? And a voice in the auditorium said, all the time in the world, my friend. I'm doing life. That was a chiller. But as a result of that, I suppose I evolved this stand-up act, which I was getting invitations to go to Australia to do various things, but mostly to sail in the Sydney Hobart race. I'm a bit of a sailor, and they thought it would be fun if I did that. But I didn't. I went over there, and I went in a few of these clubs and did ALF. I did it as a £10 migrant, you know. It's cheap to come out. I mean, it's only £10 all the way from London to Sydney. I mean, £10, assisted passage. Cost you more than that to go down to Bournemouth for the day. Mind you, Bournemouth's better than this bloody dump. And they laughed. They loved it. The harder I rubbished Australia. So I started to go to Australia and do this stand-up. And I was in Western Australia again. I hadn't done the thing in Perth by then, but... I was in a place, I think it was Bunbury, and I was sitting on the beach, and an old fellow with a kind of wrinkled prune-like face came up and said, I know you. I know you, mate. Alf Mitchell. And I said, no, Warren Garnett, actually. And, but I have to tell you a story. I have a very dear friend, an actor called Lionel Jeffries, and he lives in Bournemouth now, and if I'm sailing in Poole Harbour, I always go and say... And we were sitting with the skipper of our boat, and we were talking about being recognised, and I was saying, you know, you get people come up and they say, excuse me, can you settle a bet? And I say, oh, yeah, what? And they say, are you? And I say, what, you mean Jewish? And they say, no, are you him? Say, what, him? pointing to the ceiling. They say, no, are you? And my wife would often say, stop teasing. Yes, he is Warren Mitchell, the actor who plays Afghanistan. Lionel Jeffries and I were discussing all the times we'd been recognised. And Lionel was walking in Bournemouth one day, and there was a couple, they stopped him. The woman said, excuse me. And this is Lionel telling me the story, so I'll do it in Lionel's voice. Look, this woman said to me, excuse me. It was a good talk to his lower than me. Just as bald as me, Lionel. We were at RADA together. We were the two bald heads in the class, yes, even as young men. Excuse me, but people say that my husband here looks like Lionel Jeffries. And I said, really? He does a bit. She said, you look a bit like Lionel Jeffries too, you know. I said, do I? She said, yes. But my husband looks more like Lionel Jeffries than you do. And I said, well, for your information, madam, I am Lionel Jeffries. She said, oh, don't be silly. the other time when the audience, I'm sure they know better than you, I was filming a play called Moss. It was for BBC television. A splendid play by Bernard Copps, in which I played a very old Jewish sweet store owner who had two awful sons. And his only joy in life was his grandson, who gets killed in a road accident as a result of my negligence. And the funeral scene is very, very harrowing. But we were filming in the liberal Jewish synagogue burial grounds in Willesden. And the manager of the cemetery came up and he said, "Oh," he said, "Mr. Mitchell, I'm such a fan. Ever since I see you in that film with Tony Curtis and Sophia Loren, you was marvellous." I said, "It wasn't Sophia Loren, actually. It was Rosanna Schiaffino." He said, No. You played the old Italian count, you know, and it was all in Italian. And you come back from the wedding ceremony and she's going up the stairs taking her clothes off. It was you, Tony Curtis, and Sophia Loren." I said, "No, it was Tony Curtis, me and Rosanna Schiaffino." I said, No, you know, you couldn't consummate the marriage. You remember you cut your braces with a pair of scissors and you died trying to consummate, and you played the younger brother later on in the film." I said, "Yes, it was Rosanna Schiaffino." He said, "No, it was Sophia." I said, "It was not." He said, "Excuse me," he said, "I saw the film." Let me tell you another story about Death of a Salesman. I did it, I say, in Perth, first of all, and then I think I did it... And then I did it at the National Theatre for about 14 months, and it was a wonderful production, a beautiful... And then I did it subsequently in Sydney with Mel Gibson, and all the girls in the audience, they didn't want to look at me. "Oh, look, it's Mel. Furious. When I did it at the National, we did it for about 14 months in all. It was in repertory, not every night, but it was a wonderfully successful production. And I was laying paving stones in the garden. And there was a stonemason in the next garden. He leant over the fence and said, "Oh, Elf," he said, "you're doing it all wrong." And I said, "Oh." He said, "I'll come over and show you." So he came over and he showed me how to lay these paving stones so the water would run off. And he said, and "I'll hire you my stonecutter half price." Well, that was going to save me hours of work with a hammer and a bolster, I think it's called, trying to crack these enormous paving stones. And this thing went through the paving stones like a hot knife through butter. So in a mood of, you know, let's bring culture to the masses and grateful for his help, I said, "Look, I'm doing this play at the National Theatre. Would you like to come, you and your wife like to come as my guest?" He said, "Oh, yeah, what's that, Alf?" I said, "Well, it's a play called Death of a Salesman and it's supposed to be quite a good production." He said, "Oh, yeah, well, me and the missy, we like to go out on Friday night. We go out to the dogs normally because you sit at the table and, you know, you put your bet on with the weight. You don't even have to get up from the table. Put a bet on with the weight and put it on for you." I said, "Well, you can't do that." He said, "Oh, no, I can't do that, man. Don't be dull." Anyway, he came to see this amazing and wonderful play. And afterwards, I met he and his wife in the green room. And we sat talking about everything but the play. He didn't mention the play. We talked politics, we talked darts, we talked football. Everything under the sun, until I think he thought that no one was listening, and he leant across the table and he said, "Bit hard on a bum, innit?" That was his verdict on this great play. And when Arthur Miller came over recently for his 85th birthday, and I told that story, and I said, "You see, Arthur, you thought you wrote a masterpiece, didn't you? But not for him, you didn't. Bit hard on the bum, wasn't it?" So how did Alf come into my life? I'll tell you, the phone rang one day at home and a voice said, "Mean Wilson here, BBC, sending script round by taxi, beg you to consider this wonderful, wonderful script." I said, "Dennis, when is this for?" He said, "Next Monday." I said, "I'll do it, I'm not working." He said, "No, I want you to consider this very seriously. Wonderful, wonderful play, wonderful part, wonderful show." I said, no, I'll do it, Dennis." Now, this was an extraordinary character, Dennis Main Wilson, who produced this extraordinary show. He loved to have mountains to climb. It was no good saying, "Yes, I'll do it." He wanted to persuade me. So I let him persuade me do this piece, and I read it, and I didn't think very much of it, I have to be honest. The first joke I quite liked was Alf standing by the radio listening to Big Ben and taking his tin hunter out of his pocket, looked at the tin hunter and said, "That bloody Big Ben is wrong again." I've written to the Postmaster General. Well, I thought, yes, somebody who thinks his tin hunter is more accurate than Big Ben is probably quite an extraordinary character. But Dennis Main Wilson really was an extraordinary enthusiast, and there weren't many of them around. He was wonderful. And he adored doing this show, and he adored supporting Johnny Spade, who wrote these outrageous lines for me to say and for others to say as well, and caused great controversy. But the show I remember with some affection was, he wrote a show where the family were playing Monopoly, and Alf took it upon himself to become a property developer. You know, Mayfair, yes, it is expensive, the capital outlay, but look at the rental return. And he really fancied himself as Charlie Claw or something. It was daft, really, but it was a funny idea. Only in the writing of it, like many geniuses, Johnny couldn't be bothered with little details like who's throwing the dice. And I was throwing the dice 2-3 lines running. So I rewrote, I put a few words in just to accommodate the fact that I shouldn't be throwing the dice. And when we did our first run-through, the show ran about 37 minutes. It was supposed to run about 27, allowing for laughter in the studio. So Dennis Mainwood said, we have to cut. Send a car for our author. I will not touch one word of this brilliant script without the author being here. And I said, it's Sunday morning, Dennis. You know, Johnny was a great drinker in those days and used to spend Saturday afternoon at Fulham. People went to Fulham in those days, not for the football, for the laughs, because it really, you know, was a sort of funny football. I mean, you know, Alf said, you know, well, of course, Bobby Moore, when he finished at West Ham, they let him go to Fulham because they play a more elderly sort of game there. Well, of course, it's not true now, but... And I said, don't get him out of bed on a Sunday morning. He'd been out with the Fulham football team in the Queen's Elms last night, and he'd be absolutely unapproachable. He said, no, I won't touch a word. I won't touch a word of this wonderful, wonderful script without the author being here. And he sent a car for Johnny, who came in his camel hair coat, smoking a galoisy, and looking like death, absolute death. And they gave him a coffee. And Johnny never bothered to whisper to the director. We started the run-through. And I heard him say, well, I never wrote that line. Tell him to take it out. And I stopped and said, Johnny, I put the line in because you can't throw the dice 2 lines running. Don't matter, it's licence, isn't it? Never mind about licence, Johnny. Wonderful, wonderful. The heat generated. Great, great, my wonderful author, my wonderful star. Never mind about that. Dennis, you dragged me out of bed Sunday morning and bloody coffee's cold and... Tell him to cut the lines he's put in and the show... I can't cut the lines I've put in, Johnny, because it doesn't make sense. With me throwing... People don't mind. Oh, wonderful, wonderful, my star, my writer. Great, 2 wonderful characters. Shut up, Dennis, and clear off and get us a hot cup of coffee. And this rumbled on with this... And Dennis loved it, this passion, this argument between Johnny Spate and myself about... You know, Monopoly. And could you throw the dice 3 lines? Of course you couldn't. There was a compromise, of course. Johnny was... he was, sadly, dead now, over 2 years. The most remarkable man I ever met. I said to him, how did you start writing, Johnny? He said, well, he had this terrible stutter. I used to tell a joke, and he used to tell it himself when he did after dinner speeches. Because he used to collect cage birds. He had parrots and minor birds. And the story is that Johnny Spate went into Harrod's pet store and said to the assistant, that is a beautiful parrot in the window. How much is it? And the assistant said, £2,500. They said, £2,500 for a parrot? Can he talk? And the parrot said, a bloody sight better than you, mate. Yeah. I said to him, how did you start writing, Johnny? He said, well, I used to read in a paper about George Bernard Shaw, and I thought he was a musical comic because he was always saying funny things, you know. But I was in the library one day at Canning Town. I see a whole row of books, what he wrote, and I thought, I'll read that. And I read everything he wrote in about a year, 18 months. I thought, that is the sort of writer I want to be. And in fact, that was the sort of writer he became, a writer of polemic. His scripts are full of politics. He didn't put it in deliberately. It was Johnny that was the way he was. And he became an enormous fan of George Bernard Shaw. Everything George Bernard Shaw had written, he read, and even the prefaces and the epilogues too. He read everything. And I did My Fair Lady in Australia for the Victorian State Opera. And Johnny was out there. We were going to do a series of Alf in Australia, and he came to see me in My Fair Lady. It was amazing and lavish production. And he came to my dressing room and said, yeah, good, very good, Warren. It's a pity to ruin a good play with all that bloody music, though, isn't it? That was our John. And he was a wonderfully outspoken man, as you see his comments about My Fair Lady. We did a concert once, the cast of Till Death, in aid of victims of apartheid. The concert was organised by Canon Collins at the Albert Hall, and Johnny wrote this sketch for the four members of the family, and Alf saying, you know, bloody Canon Collins, he don't mind what rubbish he gets in his church, black, white or khaki, because the more he gets in there, the more he gets on the plate. It's for economicals, isn't it? And as the concert was organised by Canon Collins, this, of course, got big laughs in the Albert Hall. And afterwards, there was a party, and Canon Collins came up to me and said, oh, Mr Mitchell, very, very funny, very outrageous sketch you did about me. I loved it. Very, very funny. Is Mr Speed here? I'd love to meet him. And I said, yes, he's over there, Canon Collins. He has had rather a lot to drink. And he said, oh, it doesn't matter. I'd love to meet him. So I took him over. I said, Canon Collins, Johnny Spate. And he said, very, very great pleasure to meet you, Mr. Spate. And Johnny said, yeah, it's a great pleasure to meet you, Canon Collins. And then pointing to the ceiling, he said, there's nothing up there. You know that, don't you? And I thought, yeah. And Canon Collins loved it, to his eternal credit. Being able to ad-lib, of course, is one of the things that actors never learn. I mean, we hope that it'll never happen, but it does happen occasionally. It happened twice to me, quite seriously. The first time was an armchair theatre I did up in Manchester when television was live. There was none of that, record it and if we make a mistake, we'll do it all again. It was live. We had one big advantage. You didn't have to see yourself when you came home. People said you were marvellous and you could believe them, you know. You didn't have to watch it. But there was no means of recording in those days. And I tell you, live television produced in most people the absolute terrors. I mean, you know, some people went in a corner and vomited for, you know, hours on end. They couldn't eat for days. I used to get noisy and tell jokes, but that was my way of dealing with the terror of knowing when that light comes on, there's 15 million people watching you. If you forget the lines, you know. I remember Al Rakoff before a live production of a wonderful play called Requiem for a Heavyweight, which was Sean Connery's first starring role, and I, as a boxer, as a number five contender for the World Heavyweight Championship. He was very good, except he was far too good-looking because he had to have scar tissue put on him. He was a guy who had been beaten up in the ring, and I played his trainer. And Al Rakoff said, look, if anybody forgets their lines or anywhere dry, just stand still. Helen here will press the cutout key, cuts the sound out from the studio. She'll give you a prompt and wait a couple of seconds while the sound comes back on, and then you go on with the show. Oh, by the way, if anybody dries in my shows, they never work for me again. Okay, good luck, everybody. So, anyway, yes. So how did it all start? Well, it started, I suppose, a lucky accident. I was at university at Oxford with Richard Burton. We were both in the University Air Squadron in 1944, and we joined the RAF together. We went to Canada together, and I really had no idea about. He was an extraordinary man. I found him very interesting to be with. He was passionate about rugby. I didn't know him as an actor, but I knew. I would hear him and Didinger Evans. Excuse me. I would hear him and Didinger Evans from my stage, talking in the billet. You know, boom, Danny could order the butt. Boom, he could order. Boom, and I thought it was war or something. They were talking about the Battle of the Somme. It wasn't. It was Wales versus the All Blacks. And it was a great passion with him. And this is all I knew about Richard. And then when we got to Canada, this particular day, which I will never forget, was Air Force Day. And we, the cadets, we were pupil navigators. We were given the job of putting up these coconut shies and platforms for the sideshows for the public to come and... The war was still on, but the public were admitted to the Air Force Station. And Richard saw this platform and couldn't resist it. And he leapt up there and said,
was he that wishes so, my cousin Westman, nay, fair cuz, wish. And a horse, my kingdom, but a horse, and hang out your banners on the outward walls, and the cry is, oh, no, blow winds, and he did all the wonderful declamatory speeches from Shakespeare, and I was absolutely gobsmacked to see this giant hearing verse spoken as I'd never heard it spoken before. But more importantly, seeing the Air Force personnel standing around, the RCAF, Royal Canadian Air Force, and the WACS, the Canadian equivalent of the WAFs, standing there absolutely eyes wide apart and mouths agape. And I thought, I wouldn't mind doing that for a living. Having people stand there with their mouths open and their eyes... And that really planted the seed in me. So that was really how it all started. And my first real experience of acting was in the dance halls of London. The war was still on. And if you went and asked the pretty girls to dance, they mostly were, I'm sitting this one out, because they were waiting for the Yanks, who had the silk stockings or the nylons and the Hershey bars, and they called everybody ma'am. And they were superior in many ways to us, and it was difficult. So I went up to a girl and I said, would you like to dance? And bang, she was in my arms. So she said, what's an American doing in the Air Force? I said, well, I was very conscious of how dilatory my country was in coming to the aid of Britain in their time of travail. And it worked, you know. And I got fed up with him and I killed him off. I became this... I was from Poland. My family was slaughtered by the Nazis in Lidice. And that also went very well. And really, that's how the acting started. And I found that as long as I was never myself, everything went swimmingly. And that's how I became, I suppose, a character actor with funny walks, funny voices. And I realised that I must be getting near the end of my time. So I wanted to tell you a little story which... This is a sad story about an actor, a comedian, who was invited to do an after-dinner speech at a considerable amount of money because he hadn't worked for over a year. And about a week before the dinner, he was rung up by his agent who said, Harry, they've cancelled. And he said, what do you mean they've cancelled? He said, well, they had the right to cancel. They've cancelled. You see, it had to come out to time. They timed the whole function. And it's... liable to run over, and in the end it came down, they had a choice between you and a fish course. And I'm sad to tell you, they've chosen the fish course.